They know it. Mm-hmm. They're going to want to talk about Trump. He's indicted. The guy's a criminal, this and that. They're going to have riots on the street and all the kabuki theater. Meanwhile, if we talk about, it's not about Trump. It's about the parents and their children. Right. And the state is a threat. When you get Governor Newsom or Governor Whitmer or Polis, your top three potential candidates for the future presidency of the United States, mm-hmm. other than Kamala, you got these, when they're going to have to stand with their LGBTQ donors.
Right.
And so when they solidify that position, that's really where they've gone too far.
So that's Lance Wallnau, a Christian evangelist and influencer. Andy Kroll, if you can talk about him, what he's saying, and who the other leaders of this are.
Lance Wallnau is maybe one of the most important Christian evangelist figures that maybe your audience hasn't heard of. He was one of the earliest Christian right leaders to endorse Donald Trump. We're talking way back in 2015 here. He popularized this notion that Donald Trump was a modern-day Cyrus, a sort of flawed but virtuous leader who would deliver a victory for Christians. And that Cyrus idea really caught on, was a big reason that evangelicals turned out to such a big degree for Trump in 16, again in 20. Wallnau remains this bridge between the Christian right, Christian nationalism, and Trump world. Wallnau is one of a number of really influential and well-known people that are part of Ziklag, some members that your audience might have heard of, the Green family. They're the family behind Hobby Lobby. Obviously, they've had a pretty big impact in trying to strike down parts of the Obamacare law back in the Obama presidency. The Uline family have donated to this effort. They are, of course, the billionaire office supply family out of the Midwest, major, major political donors to Republicans and to Donald Trump. And then another family is the Waller family, influential in Ziklag. They are the owners of the Jockey Apparel Company, which probably a lot of people have heard of, even if they haven't heard of this family. So you have a number of really wealthy, really influential, conservative Christian families in this group. They have the means to invest not just in political work, but also in this larger cultural transformation plan that Ziklag has really really organized itself around.
I don't know what's...
Andy, talk about more in depth these three programs, Checkmate, Steeplechase, and Watchtower.
Yeah, you see an almost sort of wraparound 360-degree approach to influencing the 2024 election in these three groups. So with Steeplechase, you have mobilizing conservative pastors out in America, out in the field, to mobilize their congregations to get them out to vote. And you know, there's some concern that maybe there's fatigue about Donald Trump in 2024, that maybe conservative Christians won't turn out in the numbers they did in 2016. That's what this program is there for, getting the church as involved as possible. You have this anti-trans operation, as Lance Wallnau says in that video that you just played. They believe that going after trans people, demonizing transgender Americans, transgender healthcare, can, quote unquote, deliver swing states. That's what Lance Wallnau himself said. But then this final one, I think, is honestly perhaps the most interesting, this Operation Checkmate, putting money into mobilizing conservative voters in key counties, not just states, but the counties. So Maricopa County in Arizona, Fulton County in Georgia, the other battleground counties in the country. And then trying to put money into knocking more than a million voters off the voting rolls in these states. And you see this in a couple of ways, but what's so interesting is how the Christian right, Christian nationalism, is fusing here with the election integrity, or really the election denial movement that grew out of the 2020 election. We didn't have a lot of evidence of that before this reporting on Ziklag, but you see this bridge again between the Christian right and the election deniers in a really big way going into this election.
And how effective can they be in knocking voters off the rolls?
A little bit of money goes a long way when you are trying to get people knocked off the eligibility list for voters. That's what the experts, the political consultants, the folks that know these worlds told us in the reporting for this story. You know, Ziklag is putting, say, $800,000 or $1 million into something called Eagle AI, an artificial intelligence software that makes it easier to challenge the eligibility of voters en masse. So you're not doing it one by one. You're doing it by the hundreds, by the thousands. You don't need tens of millions of dollars, the experts told us, to be able to make those challenges and to sort of turbocharge the effort to make voters ineligible. You only need a few hundred thousand dollars, maybe $1 million. That's what this group, Ziklag, appears to be doing. So it could have an effect. And we're talking about margins again in Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, margins that are a few thousand, a few tens of thousands of voters.
And Andy, how does the election officials in every state, especially in the battleground states, their cooperation with these efforts, how might that turn out in the coming election?
Well, you have two different camps here. You have the election officials in these states and in these counties who are just trying to run a free and fair election. What we've heard from those officials is that these efforts like Eagle AI or the work of the group True the Vote, another quote-unquote election integrity group, these mass challenges to the voter rolls make an already difficult job, an already stressful job, a time-consuming job, even more difficult. It's putting just more stress on the work of these local election officials, the ones who are trying to do a good job. And then you have the officials who have sort of bought into the election integrity claims, who have bought into Donald Trump's election denial for 2020 or 2022 even. And for them, they are in some places encouraging these mass challenges. And so you might see confusion, you might see chaos, you might see voters unaware that they've been removed from the rolls in these kinds of places. So it's just creating either more stress on good officials or it's creating more chaos with officials who buy into these baseless claims about election fraud.
Andy Kroll, before you go, I wanted to pivot to ask you about Donald Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance. CNN has revealed new details about Vance's long history of disparaging people who don't have children. In addition to his comment about childless cat ladies that are running the government, talking about everyone he talks about, though she has children, Kamala Harris, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Pete Buttigieg, Vance once described Democrats as, quote, childless sociopaths. During a 2020 podcast interview, he claimed childless Americans are making the country less mentally stable.
I worry that it makes people more sociopathic and ultimately our whole country a little bit less less mentally stable. And of course, you talk about going on Twitter. Final point I'll make is you go on Twitter and almost always the people who are most deranged and most psychotic are people who don't have kids at home.
Andy Kroll, you're an investigative reporter with ProPublica. You've covered J.D. Vance. Your response to what he continually said in numerous interviews here, the point that he's making and the movement he represents.
I think it's a movement that stands for this more extreme version of conservatism. This is not George W. Bush's quote unquote compassionate conservative, or even what some of J.D. Vance's colleagues in the Senate talk about when they're talking about, you know, trying to be more pro-family, trying to be more supportive of people hoping to have kids, have a family, or just a bigger tent. J.D. Vance is demonizing huge swaths of Americans, tens of millions of Americans. And I would add, too, when I read this, some coverage of these comments of his, you know, he then tried to clean them up a bit and say, oh, I'm just trolling. But, you know, but also, you know, I do think that people should have kids, but I'm just trolling. I mean, Amy, when we talked in Milwaukee about J.D. Vance, when he said that Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist, is a better news source than Rachel Maddow, you know, he also said this. Oh, well, I was just trolling, but also I believe it. I think that when J.D. Vance says these things, no matter how he tries to clean them up, this is what he believes. This is how he would govern if he was the vice president of this country, and obviously how he'd continue to govern as a United States senator. So he's trying to have it both ways. This is the second, third, fourth time he's done this.
Andy,
and I think that voters need to recognize that.
And Andy, it's so interesting that the last piece we talked about with you in Milwaukee was in private speech. J.D. Vance said the devil is real and praised Alex Jones as a truth teller. Alex Jones, who denied that the Sandy Hook massacre took place, the killing of all of those children, saying they had gone somewhere and their parents were actors.
Right. I mean, this is just a really extreme version of conservative politics, of a Republican Party that J.D. Vance is embodying when he's saying these things about either Alex Jones and Sandy Hook, or when he's talking about childless sociopaths. I mean, this is the kind of rhetoric you really don't usually hear from a presidential ticket candidate trying to win over a broader population of Americans. But again, if he says, well, I'm just trolling, or, you know, I'm just making a joke, if the American people need to understand that behind closed doors, as we talked about, Amy, he says he believes these things, and he's not just trolling. These are positions that he takes, and the public should take that into account when they vote in November.
Andy Kroll, investigative reporter with ProPublica. We will link to your piece, Inside Ziklag, the secret organization of wealthy Christians trying to sway the election and change the country. When we come back, we go to Venezuela, where Nicolas Maduro has been declared the winner of Sunday's election, despite fraud claims by the opposition. Back in 30 seconds.
Aquí donde usted nos ve, como dueños de la tierra, para no morirnos de pobre, pasamos la vida en guerra. Somos pobres, somos ricos, nadie sabe lo que son. Con la pena de mi pueblo florecieron los aromos.
Ya no somos nosotros, we are no longer ourselves, by Patricio Mans. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Anti-government protests erupted Monday in Venezuela after National Electoral Council declared President Nicolas Maduro to be the winner of Sunday's presidential election, giving him a third term in office. According to the Electoral Council, early results show Maduro received about 51% of the vote, while opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez received 44%. But the opposition's rejecting the official results and claims it is proof of election fraud. On Monday, Nicolas Maduro accused the right-wing opposition of attempting to stage a fascist coup.
No es la primera vez.
It is not the first time we are facing what we are facing today. An attempt is being made to impose a coup d'etat in Venezuela, again, of a fascist and counter-revolutionary nature. I would call it a kind of Guaido 2.0. History repeats itself, first as a tragedy and then as a comedy. It seems that Hegel said it and then Marx popularized it. History presents itself as tragedy first and then repeats itself as comedy. We've already lived this. We saw this movie, the same movie but with a similar script. The protagonists are the same. On the one side, the people who want peace, democracy, prosperity, progress, and on the other side, elites full of hate with a fascist counter-revolutionary project tied to the U.S. empire.
On Monday, Venezuela's attorney general also accused the opposition of attempting to hack Venezuela's election system, saying the alleged cyber attack delayed reporting on vote tallies. Venezuela opposition presidential candidate Edmundo Gonzalez rejected the official results.
What happened during today's polling day was a violation of all rules, to the point that the majority of electoral registers have not been handed over. Our message of reconciliation and peaceful change still stands. We are convinced most Venezuelans also want this. Our struggle continues, and we won't rest until the will of the people of Venezuela is respected.
International response to the election in Venezuela has been mixed. China, Cuba, Russia, Iran, Honduras, Nicaragua congratulated Maduro on his re-election. Mexico also said it would recognize the election results. Meanwhile, seven Latin American nations signed a joint letter calling for a complete review of the election results. Venezuela responded to the letter by pulling diplomatic staff from those countries. Argentina, Chile, Costa Rica, Peru, Panama, Dominican Republic, and Uruguay. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. government had serious concerns about the results. The elections come at a time when Venezuela is facing an economic crisis caused in part by U.S.-led sanctions. According to the U.N., more than 7 million Venezuelans have left the country since 2015. Protesters in Caracas decried the Maduro government.
I came to the street. We want freedom. We are tired of this government. We want to change. We want to be free in Venezuela. We want our families to return here. We do not want them to leave anymore. We want to be free with our families.
For more, we're joined in New York by Alejandro Velasco, associate professor at NYU, where he's historian of modern Latin America, former executive editor of the NACLA Report on the Americas, and the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. He was born and raised in Venezuela. And in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, we're joined by Adriana Chavez, a reporter who writes for the news site Venezuela Analysis. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's stay in Caracas for a moment. Adriana, if you can respond to the results and the attacks by other Latin American countries and the opposition.
Yes, thank you so much for inviting me. And I think I need to start by saying that Venezuela right now is facing a coup attempt. That is the reality on the ground today. So we celebrated presidential elections on Sunday, and then immediately after, when the National Electoral Council gave the results, as was expected, the hardline opposition didn't recognize these results, and they immediately called for protests in the streets. So that's what we've been seeing. We've been seeing violent protests in the streets. We already saw many people getting hurt. We already saw dozens of people arrested. And according to the general attorney, a lot of these people actually have criminal records. Some of them came back recently to Venezuela. So we can see that this was something orchestrated, especially because a lot of these people have weapons. And everything indicates, everything points the finger that the extreme opposition led by Maria Corina Machado and her political organization, Vente Venezuela, is behind this new coup attempt against the government of Nicolas Maduro, who was just re-elected president of Venezuela for a third term. So as we are seeing right now, there are some right-wing governments and right-wing foreign actors who are not recognized in the Venezuelan elections. This is not new. This is something that we've seen time and time again. The same thing happened in 2018 when we had elections that year and Maduro was also re-elected. We saw the exact same thing happen. We saw right-wing governments from the region and we saw right-wing actors from the region. We saw the U.S. government not recognize the government of Venezuela. And then the next year, in 2019, we saw them support an interim government led by Juan Guaido, who didn't win any elections, simply proclaimed himself president of Venezuela. And that is basically what is happening now. We haven't seen yet anyone self-proclaiming themselves president. However, Maria Corina Machado has already said that Edmundo González, the candidate that she chose to run in the presidency, in the presidential election for her, she already said that he won. And she has said that he won by an overwhelming majority. And this is something that they have said many times before in past elections. However, up to this point, she said that she was going to present evidence of the so-called fraud, and she was going to present evidence of Edmundo having the majority of votes. And so far, she hasn't presented any evidence, which is something also typical from the opposition. In past elections, they have also said they have evidence that they won and they never actually show any proof. So, yeah, this is basically a reedition of the same thing that has happened in Venezuela in many years in the past. And all I can say is that we have practically been living a coup attempt since 2002. I believe that Venezuela has never actually escaped the coup attempt. We have been living several types of initiatives, several types of confrontations, violent attempts, violent street protests, people proclaiming themselves president, attempts at foreign invasion, assassination attempts against President Maduro. So this is an ongoing coup that has been going on for many years now.
Andreina, I wanted to ask you, first of all, there has not been a lot of attention in the United States media to the claims of the Venezuelan government that there was a massive hacking attack against the electoral system. That was announced Sunday night. Could you talk about that and what impact, if it's true, that might have had on the release of the detailed results?
Yes, so the National Electoral Council President, Elvis Amoroso, when he was given the electoral results on Sunday at midnight, he said that there was a hacking attack against the transmission system, which delayed the counting process and delayed the, being able to give a report about the electoral results. He didn't give any specific details about what happened exactly and how the system was hacked. However, he ordered an investigation, and the Venezuela General Attorney has already said that they are investigating who did this hacking attempt, where it came from, what were the consequences. All we know so far is that the attempt wasn't successful, that it delayed the process, but they didn't actually manage to hack the system, and that's why at the end of the day they were able to pronounce what were the electoral results. So we will have more details about that as the days follow and the general attorney gives more information about it.
Also, what the U.S. media also has not reported very much, that there were actually 10 candidates for president in the Venezuelan election. That's far greater choice than the American people get in your normal presidential elections. What has been the response of the other minor candidates who ran for president to the election results?
So, yeah, that is actually quite interesting because Venezuela had 10 presidential candidates. 9 of them were opposition to the Maduro government. And of course, Edmundo González, who was the far-right opposition candidate, was Maduro's main rival, but that doesn't mean that the other candidates should be dismissed. Some of them actually were presidential candidates in 2018, and they managed to get quite a significant amount of votes. So they have quite a following, they have some supporters. Some of them have actually been very open, saying that they trust the Venezuelan voting system, that they trust that the electoral results are going to be fair, are going to be correct. And many of them have already said that they trust the Venezuelan authority and the results that were given on Sunday. Some of them haven't said anything yet. And of course, there are some presidential candidates who didn't receive a significant amount of voting, and they have sort of just remained in the background at the moment. But yes, we already have not only presidential candidates saying that they trust the electoral result, but we also have many international observers that came to Venezuela, more than 900 international observers that came from over 95 countries. They came here to observe the election. We already have some reports of some of these international observers, like the National Lawyers Guild, saying that they saw a transparent, fair process, that they saw a peaceful voting process, that they didn't see any incidents, and that nothing indicates that the electoral result could have been tampered or manipulated in any way. So,
okay.
Yes,
Andreina, I'd like to bring it, if possible, Andreina, I'd like to bring in Professor Alejandro Velasco, of associate professor at NYU, historian of modern Latin America. Professor, your response to what is going on in Venezuela post the election?
Yeah, well, first, thanks so much for having me. Some of what we're seeing in Venezuela, as Andreina was commenting on, seems to adhere to moments that we've had of electoral contests and disputes in the past. There are some really important differences here. I think the primary claim that the Venezuelan government is leading or is feeding into allegations of fraud is that it's yet to release the vote-by-vote, the machine-by-machine tallies that it has done in previous elections in much shorter time frame than it has at this stage. You know, hacking allegations aside, you know, the question of whether or not it can match the actual returns from each machine to what has reported as the electoral victory of Maduro remains a big question, and it's something that we have seen from not just right-wing governments in the region, but also left and center-left governments, the Brazilian foreign ministry, the Colombian government under Petro, the Mexican government as well. All of them issued recently a declaration or a statement asking the Venezuelan electoral authorities to release this data in order to make sure that there's trust in the outcome. So on the other hand, of course, you have the opposition, which, as Andreina well mentioned, you know, certainly led by Maria Corina Machado, has in the past made allegations of fraud that have been unsubstantiated. The difference now is that in a press conference yesterday, they released what was a very significant body of these electoral returns that people can go and check online, and they can match with what the witnesses at the various precincts actually had at the end of their at the voting night on Sunday. So you know, right now, the real struggle, the real battle in terms of thinking, you know, what happened on Sunday is lays at the feet of the National Electoral Council, and to the extent that they can dispel doubts, dispel criticism about the actual return by releasing this evidence, will have greater clarity.
And Professor Velasco, if you can talk about the effect of the sanctions and the role of the U.S. government that you suspect now or that has been proven. The Washington Post, on a very interesting piece on sanctions, actually U.S. sanctions around the world, and they quote in that piece Thomas Shannon, who served as Undersecretary for Political Affairs at the State Department under President Trump, who said, this is the point I made at the time. I said the sanctions were going to grind the Venezuelan economy into dust and have huge human consequences, one of which would be out-migration, said Thomas Shannon. And migration is a major issue with millions of people leaving Venezuela since 2015. Can you talk about that and where you see the U.S. role today?
Yeah, absolutely. The vast academic literature, both in the case of Venezuela and more broadly around the world, has proven that sanctions have negative intended political outcomes than those that they seek. In most cases, the significant effects are felt not by governments in power, but by the population at large. We have to remember that when Trump came into office, he instituted what he himself called a maximum pressure campaign against Venezuela, which Marco Rubio called the harshest set of sanctions since the Cuban embargo of the 1960s and, of course, until today. It's unquestionable that that has had a massive impact on the Venezuelan economy and certainly led to so many people leaving, millions over the course of the last 10 years. However, it's also true that it has shifted the policy agenda of the Venezuelan government towards dollarization and towards reducing some of the social programs that it had championed under the presidency of Hugo Chavez, which has in turn led to discontent on the part of the population. Some of what you showed in the clip, right, people saying, my family have left, I want them to return, I can't get by if I don't have access to dollars, that certainly is feeding some of the discontent that we're seeing on the streets and also reflected in the polls.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion actually in Spanish and post it on our website at democracynow.org. In Espanol, you can just check that out. Alejandro Velasco is associate professor of NYU and historian of modern Latin America, born and raised in Venezuela, former executive editor of the Nacla Report on the Americas, author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. And thank you so much to Adriana Chavez, Venezuela Analysis, as her group, speaking to us from Caracas. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of development to lead our fundraising team You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Gester, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for Democracy Now!
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. Fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.